harrowing crate is a narrow place the sow is put in. There's some space on the side. Typically, they don't have any bedding in them. They're on a cement floor, and there's slatted floor, and then there's liquid manure systems underneath, and the manure works its way through the slats. Then gestation stalls, where rows and rows of sows were just put in, basically enough space for them to stand up and lay down. They can't turn around or anything.
One doesn't need to be an animal rights activist to be troubled by what we make animals endure for the sake of placing low-priced pork on our dinner plates.
You know, the more you look over the high walls of our industrial agriculture, especially in the meat area, the less appetizing that food looks.
Today on A World of Possibilities, Savoring Swine, the Economics and Politics of Pork. The trend towards intensive confinement, factory-style meat production is changing the quality of the pork on our plates and the treatment of the pigs who provide it. It's also dividing the agricultural community, driving small-scale family farmers out of business and off the land that's been theirs for generations.
In our county, we've lost at least 85% of them. People try to gloss over it, but there's some animosity.
Is this the triumph of efficiency and cost-effectiveness, or a case of too much, too fast, with too little concern for the long term?
When we use that word unsustainable, we have a very precise meaning in mind. It really does mean a system that cannot go on indefinitely because it's consuming its foundations, its roots. The other sense in which I think the industrial meat system is unsustainable is that it depends on ignorance.
I'm Mark Summer. Join us as we trace the trail from farm to fork, as we track the true price of pork. Welcome to A World of Possibilities. What's the source of that savory pork chop on your dinner plate? What about that sizzling slice of breakfast bacon? Did it originate on a diversified family farm in a muddy Midwestern barnyard? Or did it come from a large-scale confinement operation, an industrial meat production plant? How were the animals treated? Were they fed on subsidized corn? Was the pig given antibiotics? Is the pork fat and rich or lean and watery? Does it even matter? We begin our investigation of the economics and politics of pork with one of the preeminent food and agriculture journalists working today, Michael Pollan. Author of the best-selling book, The Botany of Desire, Pollan's most recent volume is The Omnivore's Dilemma. He's Knight Professor of Science and Environmental Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley, a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, and recipient of numerous journalistic awards. To track the trail of pork from hoof to plate, Michael Pollan joins us now from the radio studio in the Journalism School at UC Berkeley.
It used to be a kind of family affair. Everybody in rural places would keep a pig as kind of a composting machine. You would feed them your food wastes, and at the end of the season, you would get a whole lot of meat for the winter. But as we industrialized commodity crops, that led to the industrialization of the animals that could eat those commodity crops. This kind of created a vacuum effect. When you had feedlots that could set up these industrial systems and buy corn and other commodity crops like soybeans so cheaply, it virtually sucked the animals off the farms. And they now live in these really miserable cities where you will get tens of thousands of hogs in one place, and they live indoors now, by and large, because they've been, for many reasons, but they've been bred to be lean. As you made them more lean, they had less back fat and therefore could not survive winters in places like Iowa. So they moved indoors and they live atop these septic tanks, in effect, on metal slats. And we feed them, you know, huge quantities of corn and various pharmaceuticals to make them grow as fast as possible. And the result is lots of cheap, not very high quality, but cheap pork. And that apparently suits the American consumer just fine.
It's been asserted that animals raised in confinement are in such a state of frustration and panic that it actually flavors the meat and breaks it down in certain ways, the inactivity. What do you make of those claims?
Well, from my own experience, I think that it's absolutely true that animals that first get to live according to their natures and their desires and get to eat what they evolved to eat produce better meat. You know, there's scientific proof of this in beef and in pork. In beef, it's, you know, you get dark cutters, which is that dark beef you sometimes see in the market. It's equally fresh, but it's dark because the animal was so terrified at its slaughter that it produced a surge of stress hormones that does compromise the taste of it. There's a mushiness that comes into pork under the same circumstances. and also the meat byproducts that we feed these animals. You know, is it surprising that beef that is fed chicken manure, which beef often is, doesn't taste as tasty as beef-fed grass? I mean, it seems to me it stands to reason.
Beef is fed chicken manure.
Yes, that's a routine and approved feed. It's called chicken litter, and it's everything kind of scraped out of the bottom of a chicken house, which includes bits of feed, feces, whatever the bedding was, and it is simply shoveled into onto the feedlot to feed cattle. Besides the sheer disgust of it, the risk of it is that, of course, you've been feeding chickens the meat and bone meal from cattle that you're no longer allowed to feed cattle since mad cow disease in 1997. These rules were changed. But any bits of meat and bone meal from cows that the chickens missed would end up in the litter and therefore back into the diet of cattle. So it's one of the big loopholes in the effort to control mad cow disease in this country. But we essentially treat our animals as disposals, and whatever excess material of any kind that has any nitrogen or protein or caloric content, we will feed to an animal that will eat it. And pigs are omnivores, and they will eat just about anything you give them. And cattle, you know, if forced to, will eat all sorts of things you wouldn't think that they could eat or digest. But again, to tolerate some of these bizarre diets, they do need antibiotics, because they would get sick otherwise.
When they get a steady diet of antibiotics, what is that doing to the meat, and what is that doing to the health of the human beings who consume it?
It does take a toll. The big problem with feeding antibiotics routinely to livestock that we're eating is the evolution of strains of bacteria that can withstand exposure to those antibiotics. What's happening with these antibiotics as we squander them on our livestock production is we are squandering a very important public good. The ability of a given antibiotic to make us healthy, to cure us of infections, we are sacrificing to the cause of cheap meat. And that is just one of the many hidden costs of cheap meat. It looks like a deal, you know, when you can buy that cheap bacon or that cheap burger at McDonald's, but the real cost is born elsewhere. It seemed to me if the cost of meat had to reflect the real costs to the public health system, to the environment, to the treasury in the form of subsidies, cheap meat wouldn't be so cheap. To sell it, you know, at those kind of prices is really to price it irresponsibly. One of the things I like about organic food is it is more responsibly priced because there aren't those hidden costs to society or to nature. But our industrial system is full of hidden costs that all of us are paying all the time, even as we, you know, as we chow down on this seemingly cheap food.
And industrial meat production is very much involved in the petrochemical economy, isn't it? I mean, it's...
Oh, don't get me started. Yes. Well, this is another cost of cheap food, and that is that it takes an enormous amount of energy to make that cheap food. The corn that those pigs and cows and chickens are eating, every bushel of it took between a quarter and a third of a gallon of fossil fuel to produce. You know, these animals are really sipping fossil fuel on their feedlots. They're not just eating corn, they're eating oil. If you want to trace that food chain that they're part of back to the source, you have to go past that cornfield in Iowa and go all the way to the Persian Gulf. That is really where that food chain begins. Without cheap oil, we would be eating very differently in this country.
When I spoke to Paul Willis at Nyman Ranch, he said that the industrial meat production system is totally not sustainable. It's not just unethical, but it's not going to last. What do you see coming down the line? I mean, on the one hand, you think industrial meat production is the way of the future, but is it really, or are we being forced, are we going to be forced to change by the very market forces that seem to bring it into existence in the first place?
Yeah, I don't think it is the way of the future. Paul Willis is a very wise man, and I think he's absolutely right to say that the system is unsustainable. And also that when we use that word unsustainable, we have a very precise meaning in mind. I know it gets tossed around all the time, but it really does mean a system that cannot go on indefinitely because it's consuming its foundations, its roots, and because things we know are going to happen that will make it impossible to go on. One of them is the end of cheap oil. But there are other things as well. The price of corn may not stay low. that may remove that enormous advantage that feedlots have over farms as a way to grow meat. And you might find some of these animals being liberated from their cities and heading back to the farms, which would be a wonderful thing. The other sense, and the last sense in which I think the industrial meat system is unsustainable, is that it depends on ignorance. And any system, as we've learned with the fall of communism, that depends on ignorance will not last, because transparency and information will, in the end, triumph. You know, the more you look over the high walls of our industrial agriculture, especially in the meat area, the less appetizing that food looks. People who know more will eat less of it. I find it hard to believe we'll be talking about this kind of agriculture in 50 years.
What's been promoted by the Department of Agriculture and agronomists for many, many years is that they say it's modern agriculture is basically a form of industry like other industry. And they say, in essence, that any modern society is going to have to adopt this kind of agriculture.
The idea that this system is inevitable in any sense is simply false. It's a very recent system. It's only 50 years old or less. It didn't have to be this way. It is this way because of, as a result of certain decisions taken by our government. Those decisions could be different. In doing my research for the book, I explored a lot of very sustainable farms. I went to Paul Willis's farm, which is a very impressive example that shows that you can grow pork in a way that is much better product, much better for the animals, much better for the environment, and not that much more money either. But I've also gone to see even more radical alternatives. I spent a week working on a very sustainable farm in Virginia called Polyface Farm that grows six different animals, including hogs, in a very interesting symbiotic rotation that actually improves the quality of the land and creates very tasty meat. So there's a whole other paradigm to think of it. Instead of thinking of the pig as a protein machine with flaws, which is essentially how industrial hog production imagines the pig, this farmer, whose name is Joel Salatin, he sees this as an animal whose innate desires and proclivities he can exploit to do work on his farm. And as he says, this is a kind of farm machinery. He calls them his pigerators. It's a kind of farm machinery he really likes because it appreciates over time, never needs any kind of fixing or attention. And when you're done with it, you eat it.
I'm really intrigued by what animates two different paradigms. The one is the industrial whole system, and the other is what you might call a natural whole system.
Yeah, one is based on the logic of industry, which is the factory. You put in this input and you get that output. The input in the case of a hog would be corn and pharmaceuticals, and the output is cheap meat. The other system is realizing that animals exist in an ecological system and that there is another logic to that, and a whole other concept of efficiency, by the way. There's industrial efficiency, but then there's biological efficiency, and that's what you see on Joel Salatin's Polyface Farm. And it is a whole other way to conceive it. We have only begun to understand ecology well enough to design these ecological farming systems. This is relatively new. You know, there are whole other ways we can do it.
Well, what I'm struck by is that in the industrial paradigm is basically a linear paradigm.
Yes.
And the ecological paradigm is many-dimensional. And each thing helps something else, but in much more complex ways than industry, which means that it has a greater resilience and robustness. Is that right?
No question. It's very resilient and robust, because in general, each animal is also taking care of the pest problems of the other animal. They're not afflicted by the same diseases, so if you have them in relationship, you actually diminish the diseases. It's monoculture, you know, that we're really talking about here. This is the original sin of industrial agriculture, that if you have all pigs all the time in one place, that is a perfect environment for disease and in crops for weeds and disease. You know, and nature never does anything in monoculture. Monoculture is an industrial idea. It's the factory idea. You produce lots of one thing, and you get really good at it because you're just focusing on that one thing, and all your machines are designed for that one thing. But if you go to a multi-species system, suddenly you do not have problems with disease. You know, there are amazing efficiencies that come out of thinking this way. And the problem is there are scale issues. To what extent can you scale these things up? And there are know-how issues. So the ability to devise these very intricate and interesting systems, you know, who's going to do that work? And I think that's a real question. I mean, we just need another generation of farmers who think like ecologists, getting back to the land.
Michael Pollan, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma. After a short break, we travel to Curlew, Iowa, to meet Berkshire hog farmer Lisa Siebrecht.
Sausage and even spam. Oink. A nice rolled roast or a chop on to fry. Oink. A big bag of pig skins can make me cry. I like pig products. I never deny them. Pig products. Bake them or fry them. Oink.
You're listening to A World of Possibilities, a production of the Mainstream Media Project. To hear the podcast of this program and to access our show archives, please visit our website at aworldofpossibilities.com or visit iTunes.
Oink.
Life has never been easy on American Oink. Family farms, but it's seldom been harder than in the 1990s. Oink. In the 5 years between 1992 and 1997, almost half of Iowa's pork producers went out of business. It's all about numbers these days, says Lisa Siebrecht, a pig farmer in northwestern Iowa. Profit margins have become razor thin because huge integrated corporate farms flood the market with millions of pounds of low-cost lean pork, advertised as the other white meat. In order to make family farming commercially viable again, one must carve out a top-end niche market in the gourmet or natural food sector. As pig farmers for Eden Farms, a coalition of independent family farmers, Lisa Siebrecht and her family raise Eden Natural brand pork from a 350-year-old breed called Berkshire's. They're a slower-growing pig known for richly flavored marbled meat. To describe the opportunities and challenges facing a gourmet pork producer, Lisa Siebrecht joins us now by phone from her family's farm in Curlew, Iowa. What was so wrong with the way hogs used to be raised? Didn't that give farmers a reasonable compensation and was a more freer life for the pigs?
Yeah, it's hard to raise a lot of pigs that way. You know, and everybody now, they make a buck a pig and raise a million pigs, they make $1 million, you know, whereas it used to be you could make maybe $10 a pig or so and have raised maybe 1,000 a year, you know, and you'd be all right, but I think it's all a numbers game now.
How many family farms are left in your county, and what percentage of what was there maybe 10, 20 years ago?
Well, there's a lot of family farms that are grain farmers yet, and cattle. You know, as far as hogs, in our county, we've lost at least 85% of them.
So does that make for a real shift in just the nature of the community and the culture there?
Yeah. People try to gloss over it, but there's some animosity. It's getting better. It's not what it used to be because, you're getting used to it. And, I mean, for some people, they either had to quit farming or they started raising pigs for somebody else. My main problem is because we still farrow to finish, which means we have the babies and we have the sows that have babies, and then we raise them all the way to when they go to Eden Natural. It's the diseases that are brought in. A lot of the pigs come in from Canada and they come in from North Carolina. It's frustrating. There's some reproductive diseases that are a problem, and there's a lot of respiratory diseases coming in.
The kinds of pigs that are raised in these corporate farms are a particular kind of hybrid. How does your stock differ from these hybrid lean pigs?
Yeah, ours are Berkshire's. We raise purebreds. Some people in the group have crossbreds. It's mainly the difference in the meat quality. There's more fat, there's more back fat, there's more intermuscular fat. The water retention in the meat fibers is much better, so we've got a juicier, tastier product. You know, the big deal was for years, lean. We've got to have lean, lean pigs, you know, because everybody's on this fat kick. Well, the pendulum swung too far. A lot of people can't eat the stuff that's coming out of these sheds.
When you look at the consumer, after all, the consumer seems to be the one that is making the choices to buy this cheap pork. How do you feel about the consumer and, and the consumer's sort of responsibility?
Yeah, they want all this stuff, but they don't want to pay for it, you know, and it costs extra to raise it that way. The way we do it, you know, raising Berkshires costs more, you know. because of the fact they grow slower. Our litter average is small. You know, we don't have as many pigs per litter. It's frustrating, but you just learn to accept it, I guess, especially in the Midwest. You know, but the people out here, they've grown so accustomed to these operations that it doesn't insult them or it doesn't threaten them, I guess, the majority of them.
Mm-hmm. So you've been what they call a niche producer.
Right.
What are the various hurdles that a niche producer faces that the big corporate industrial pig operations don't?
Well, finding a market, I guess, and finding distributors that want it.
You've found difficulty with that? Some distributors say, look,
yeah,
I don't want to deal with this small volume?
That is one of the major things. You know, you start turning on a distributor and he likes your product and all of a sudden starts ordering more and more, and all of a sudden you don't have the pigs to fill the demand. Well, that's a killer. Then he'll go somewhere else and find it. That's been a hurdle for us for sure. We've been trying to grow slow, but as we grow slowly, there's more people that are entering the Berkshire market, and so our competition has increased. So that's kind of scary. You know, like the inputs for the big corporations, they've got cheap labor working in these sheds. They can buy inputs, you know, in mass quantities and get bigger discounts and such like that.
You know, it's always been said, whether you're in the stock market or in farming, that diversification is the best way to go,
mm-hmm,
so that you can ride through any number of circumstances and still survive.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a chance that the old-style farming may see a return at some point, maybe modified?
As far as raising cattle and hogs
and grain and something, so that if one thing goes wrong, something else may still come through.
If we can find some young people to come back. But, you know, the average age of the farmer in Iowa is in his 60s. You know,
really?
They're not going to raise pigs anymore. But I don't know if some young kids would want to come back to that. You know, there are a few. There are a few, but I don't see it coming back in the numbers that we used to have. I'm sure they'd love to, but it's just, especially getting into grain farming, the cost of land is just skyrocketed, and of course all your inputs, your tractors and our fertilizers and our chemicals, and you've almost got to have some family help along the way.
I really wish you the best in this. I know it can be difficult, and
yeah, we had, about last week I was ready to just say the heck with it. We had a flu go through, and usually your sows don't get sick, but our sows got sick, and all you try to use all the precautions you can, but when you've got that many pigs in the area, and the diseases even travel on flies, you know, it's pretty hard. But
wow.
But of course, there's days that it's just wonderful, you know. You get outside, and you get to, you know, work with animals, plus, you know, we farm quite a few acres of corn and soybeans, and harvest and planting, of course, is always exciting.
I can relate to what you say. I've never been a commercial farmer, but my wife and I out here, we grew apples. We were trying to do the whole thing organically, and we got all kinds of...
all bugs.
Yeah. So, and it ended up not being really practical. But I have to say, the experience of being on the land and the cycles of nature and all of that, it's almost like you pay a tax for living such a good life.
Yeah. We don't do it for the money, that's for sure.
No, there never was any money in farming. There never was.
Oh, but you eat well.
Yeah, right. Lisa Siebrecht, a Berkshire pig farmer with Eden Natural. Pigs are curious creatures. They're foragers, omnivores, garbage eaters. They like rooting around. Paul Willis knows and likes pigs. Raised in a family of pig farmers, Paul now manages the highly regarded Nyman Ranch Pork Company out of the same home where he spent his childhood. Nyman Ranch pigs are raised only on family farms, where they enjoy the now rare privilege of growing up in open-range conditions closely aligned with their genetic predispositions, foraging in fields, nesting, and building up a comfy layer of back fat to insulate them from frigid Midwestern winters. To describe life in pig heaven, Paul Willis joins us now by phone from his farmhouse in Thornton, Iowa.
Farrowing crate is a fairly narrow place the sows put in. There's some space on the side. Typically, they don't have any bedding in them. They're on a cement floor, and there's a slatted floor, and then there's liquid manure systems underneath, and the manure works its way through the slats. Then came what they call the gestation stalls, where rows and rows of sows were just put in, just basically enough space for them to stand up and lay down. They can't turn around or anything.
Are they ever let out, or?
No. They're bred there. They stay there. They're only let out to go to a farrowing crate. They have their pigs after 17 days. Typically, they were weaned, and then they're rebred, and they go back into the gestation stall. So basically, they live in a box, or if you call it living.
Well, for an intelligent animal, what is that like to be confined in a space where you can't even turn around and you can't see anything? It's like the ultimate solitary confinement.
Well, for an animal that, you know, if they were searching for their food, they're curious. Pigs are very curious, by the way. You know, and so they do a lot of rooting and exploring and so on. And then generally that's part of what they do in looking for their food, rooting and, you know, they eat a lot of roots and so forth. They do some grazing and so forth. And when they can't do that, they need to do something. So a lot of times they'll just chew on a bar or something like that. It's actually, they call it learned helplessness.
Uh-huh.
And it's a kind of a psychotic behavior, I guess you'd say.
Learned helplessness, that's an interesting phrase.
I've heard the term used, you know, but you get a lot of very repetitive. I don't know if you've ever been to a zoo where mm-hmm. things weren't the way they're supposed to be, and you'd see a leopard or something just pacing, you know, just turning in circles or something like that, because they didn't have an environment where they had any kind of stimulus in their environment. To me, the animal still deserves a quality of life. You know, I know that we raise animals for food, but they do have a life and should be allowed to, in my opinion, exhibit those natural inclinations.
When this kind of confinement farming began to move in, was there a debate at that time among farmers about whether this was really justified?
This has been a very divisive issue for years, and it's sort of the economics against the ethics. And these systems can be put in where they can contain thousands of animals, literally, and you can produce pork that way. As far as raising pigs that way, that's debatable. It depends on what you call raising pigs. It really picked up speed in the 90s, and even this past year, there were just a record number of these buildings being put up. Each one of them holds maybe 2,500 pigs.
So it's basically almost like taking the industrial assembly line model that we use to manufacture cars and things like that and manufacture meat instead in this way.
Exactly. I mean, that's why I refer to them as hog factories.
Were the agricultural extension agents and others promoting this very strongly, these practices?
Let me put it this way. There seemed to be some of the agricultural schools in particular that were, you know, leaning toward this. They saw this as the wave of the future, and they were getting funds and everything to investigate various problems that these systems created, try to solve the problems. The odor problem is a big one.
The odor is greater because it's so concentrated and there's no sort of soil to absorb?
The odor that comes out of these buildings is nothing that I ever experienced as I grew up. It's a combination of ammonia, hydrogen sulfide, and a number of other things. You know, very toxic if these buildings have to have, exhaust fans. If those fans go out because of an electrical failure or something like that, you have literally just minutes to get out or you're gonna die.
Those gases are also methane, aren't they? That's
methane, hydrogen sulfide, ammonia. I'm sure there's even more complexity to it than that. But the odor that's in them, I mean, it gets in your hair, your skin. People breathe that out.
Paul Willis of the Nyman Ranch Pork Company. I'm Mark Summer, and this is A World of Possibilities, distributed by the WFMT Radio Network.
Will it happen on the slews of Madison? I was doing my catfishing there. Then from across the road come a little old man, grinning and drinking his beer. And he said, I'm a Henry, the hog farm. And I'm doing the best that I can. make what I make, and then the government take and leave me a penniless man. Oh, he said, you know, I'm not just the average farmer. I got 600 acres and more. I got 2,000 hogs.
This is A World of Possibilities, a production of the Mainstream Media Project. If you wish to contact us, please direct emails to comments@aworldofpossibilities.com. This program is distributed by the WFMT Radio Network.
He makes what he makes, and then the government takes at least 400 his empty beer cans. Ah, one more time for Henry, the hog farmer, who is doing the best that he can. He makes what he makes, and then the government takes and leaves him a penniless man.
I'm Mark Summer, and this is A World of Possibilities. Coming up in this half hour, we hear from Temple Grandin, a world-famous animal husbandry specialist whose keen insights into the minds and emotions of farm animals is revolutionizing the handling and slaughtering procedures for factory meat production facilities. We'll also speak with Mark Bogus, Director of Animal Science at the National Pork Board, the industry trade group. But first, we continue our conversation with Paul Willis, manager of Nyman Ranch Pork Company, speaking with us from his farm in Thornton, Iowa.
I met Bill Nyman in 1994 and told him how I was raising pigs, and he was marketing to especially some of the restaurants in San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I came back to Iowa and sent some pork out there, and I'd been looking for a market for, if you will, free-range pigs. You know, free-range chickens were already popular.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we sent some pork from the pigs that we were raising, and the people were highly taken with the flavor and the eating quality, if you will. I shipped 30 pigs the first time, and then people loved it, and it really started growing, and Nyman Ranch decided to go for and create a national brand. And then on this end, they started creating a network of farmers that also, you know, did something similar to what I was doing.
Now, what are the economics of it? In other words, how much more does it cost per pound to produce and market this higher quality free-range pigs?
First of all, the thing is, what do you need to do to make a living? So in our system, you need to be paid more per pig because you cannot raise the numbers compared to these industrial systems. But the other difference is that you're not paying for a $200,000 or $300,000 building. One of our farmers might be able to raise 600 to 1,000 pigs without extra help.
You can make it work the way you're doing it by raising few but getting a better price because the quality's better.
The other thing is that raising pigs is generally not the only enterprise on our farms. They're usually diversified farms. And we require our farmers to be family farmers. In other words, they own the animals themselves, are involved in the taking care of them. And in many cases, they're passing skills on from one generation to the next.
One of the questions that comes up for me is, if you're in one of the better supermarkets, you will find Nyman Ranch and other premium pork products, and they are considerably more expensive. So they can reach a kind of niche market. How big is that niche market in terms of the whole volume of pork that's sold?
I think it's relatively small. We're providing about 2,500 hogs per week, and in the Upper Midwest, the number of hogs slaughtered per week is well over a million.
Wow.
But, you know, we're part of a natural and organic food movement, if you will, where it seems to be growing rapidly. It seems to me that people that sort of discover healthy food go through kind of a one-way swinging door, you know. It becomes something that's on their mind. And also, I don't think in the long term animal factories are sustainable. There's just too much of one thing in one place.
As I understand it, there's actually some, at least anecdotal basis for the assertion that when you raise pigs in unconfined conditions, the way you raise them, the flavor will be different in part because the animal grows up without that stress that releases things like lactic acid that changes the composition and flavor of the meat. Is that right?
Yes. The meat industry wants a leaner animal, and these leaner animals are just tend to be more hyper, and they tend to get nervous easier, and like you said, the lactic acid is released because they're much more easily stressed, and it leads to a breakdown of the muscle structure. And liquid, if you see a package of pork in the store and you see liquid in the package, you know, you don't want to be buying that because that's because of the muscle structure breaking down. All of these things in combination make a dramatic difference in the end eating quality of the product.
Paul Willis, manager of the Nyman Ranch Pork Company. With their exacting standards for animal welfare, food quality and safety, use of antibiotics, and commitment to family farming, do these small niche producers exert any impact on corporate giants like Smithfield Foods? What are the challenges facing industrial pork producers managing huge confinement facilities? Mark Bagas currently directs the Department of Animal Science at the National Pork Board, but he grew up on a family farm in a part of Iowa once designated as the poorest county in the country. To provide a more mainstream perspective on changes and challenges occurring in the pork industry, Mark Bagas joins us by phone from a hotel room in Urbana, Illinois, where he's attending the 2006 Reciprocal Meat Conference at the University of Illinois.
In Iowa, there's an awful lot of hogs. We'll range from 102 or 3 degrees in the summer down to 25, 30 below zero sometimes in the winter. And, you know, I've got to be honest, those pigs that are outdoors on those kinds of environments really do suffer. Productivity suffers. They're much harder to keep healthy. They're much harder to keep in condition. So they have about 3 months in the spring where they're pretty comfortable and 3 months in the fall, and the rest of the time they're in pretty tough shape. And so what confinement systems do is they take all that variation in environmental ambient temperatures and precipitation and sun and sunburn. White pigs sunburn very easily, for example, and they mitigate that, and they make it much more comfortable for the pigs year-round. Now, to do it efficiently and to do it cost-effectively, they have to minimize space, and they have to be able to take care of each individual animal and make sure that she has exactly the right amount of nutrition, exactly the right amount of care when she needs it in terms of mating or vaccination or treatment for some kind of ill. So it's just not a very simple, easily addressed issue, because most of the people that would like to see those sows outside don't really understand the total ramifications of what weather and what climate and what the effects are environmentally on the way those sows maintain themselves.
Well, from the consumer point of view, you know, what have you seen in, if you've done any market research to find out how much more people are willing to pay for better facilities and better treatment of the animals?
I know those studies exist, and I know that there's an awful lot of consumers that are willing to pay for, they consider more of a socially responsible production system or for some kind of added quality or some kind of health benefit. Those opportunities are difficult to develop, particularly on a large scale, and the way the United States is right now, that's been somewhat of a limitation. That is one reason that some of the niche markets are having more of an impact on the industry. That's where some of that's coming from, because there are consumers that are willing to pay more for a bedded animal or a outdoor production system and those kinds of things. They do cost more money. I mean, sometimes it comes down to that being a pretty critical consideration for some consumers. So.
Right, they do. And in fact, if you go to Nyman Ranch, it's probably $8 or $9 a pound. You know, it's maybe twice as much, and that's really at the top end, of course.
Right. Well, I definitely think that there's going to be more of a service industry where niches develop to address particular concerns or particular consumer demand for specific characteristics, whether it's really high eating quality or whether it's outdoor production or whether it's antibiotic free. I don't know, Mark, how that's going to break out long term, though, in terms of demand for pork and prices and where we're going to go as a planet when we talk about feeding an awful lot of people in the future. So when push comes to shove and people just need pork or they just need protein, you know, there are some vulnerabilities. Not to say that it isn't viable and it isn't going to happen, because it is. And some of those producers are really challenging the industry to step up in terms of how we manage pork quality, for example, and how we produce better eating quality for the consumer. And they're the ones that are taking on the antibiotic-free production systems. And I'm sure at some point there's going to be more pressure brought to bear to remove all antibiotics. So they're doing some of the cutting-edge, difficult work. But it's more difficult and it's more expensive.
Mark Bogus of the National Pork Board. In a moment, renowned animal husbandry specialist Temple Grandin.
I like rolling around in mud, playing in the yucky all day. Covered with grime, really feels so good. It keeps the biting things away. I'm happiest when I'm not so clean.
This is a world of possibilities, a production of the Mainstream Media Project. Copies of this program are available on CD and can be requested by email at comments@aworldofpossibilities.com.
Dr. Temple Grandin intuitively understands livestock. She can see as they see and hear what they hear. She's used her sensibilities as a woman with autism to interpret the behavior of livestock. A professor at Colorado State University in Fort Collins, she's the author of the best-selling book Animals in Translation. Her insights into the fear, fun, and folly of pigs, chickens, and cattle have led her to redesign livestock containment, transport, loading, and slaughter facilities to make them more humane. Temple Grandin joins us now by phone from Red Deer, Alberta, where she's working with cattle producers and the Alberta Farm Animal Care Association.
Sow stalls, where a pig basically is living in a crate or in a stall where she can't turn around for most of her life, I think that needs to be changed. And I use a very simple way to suggest for changing it. Imagine if you lived in an airline seat. That's basically what we're asking the sow to do. There's also genetic problems with pigs. We've bred the pig to grow really fast, and there's been feet and leg problems that needs to definitely be corrected. And I think sow stalls need to be eliminated, but we have to do it right, because when we bred pigs to be really lean, we accidentally, nobody did this on purpose, bred a pig that's a much nastier fighter. They fight more, they bite tails more. You know, they're like lean and mean. And there actually been some studies done at Purdue University that showed that the lean-lined pigs are meaner pigs, and they fight more. Well, for the last 20 years, you've had sows living in stalls where they can't fight with other pigs. So there's been no informal selection pressure, you know, for sows to get along with each other. Because normally, back when sows were raised in pens, a really nasty sow, she'd just be sold and gotten rid of. And that informal, it's called culling pressure, is no longer there. And to make a system work where there are no sow stalls, there's going to have to be some genetic selection for sows that are going to get along with each other better, for gentler, nicer sows. So genetic selection for pigs is going to have to be part of making a group housing work for sows. And I think it's something that needs to be done. And I think actually if it's done right, I think it can be a win-win situation. But you don't just take these mean old ladies out and put them together, because they're going to do some very nasty biting on the back end on private parts.
We've spoken with a number of sort of specialty pork producers, like Nyman Ranch and others.
Yes.
And they say that by raising the animals in a kind of a more open situation and feeding them no antibiotics, et cetera, they're getting a much better quality of meat and
they get a very, very fine quality of pork at Nyman Ranch. I've eaten their pork. It's beautiful pork. And genetics is a big factor in that. They're using older type of pigs, slower growing, finer muscle fiber pig, and a lot of this increased quality is the genetics of their pigs. They've got some very, very nice pig genetics. See, when the industry went in to grow really fast, gigantic loins, no fat at all on the pig, they bred actually tougher meat, larger muscle fibers, much tougher meat that some of it you have to use a steak knife to cut it. And I did not realize how tough some of the regular pork had gotten until I went and gave a pig handling talk at a Nyman conference and I ate some of their pork loin. It was absolutely beautiful. Even after the hotel had tried to wreck it under the heat lamp, it was still beautiful.
Well, so is there any going back that, you know, the people at Nyman Ranch say, look, we're doing, I mean, we're making modern modifications, but we're doing the same kind of animal husbandry that was done for hundreds of years, really.
Well, I think what's going to happen, because I'm a very practical person, is there's going to be a large sector of the market that's going to, you know, we'll be getting the Nyman Ranch, you know, type of pork. But there's still going to be a large intensive commercial sector, especially, you know, with all the low-income people. But I think that that intensive sector can be greatly improved. And one of the things we need to do is get rid of the sow stalls. The other thing we need to do when we work on breeding better pigs is we've got to breed better feet and legs, because these sows just aren't living very long. They're getting rid of them after the third litter of pigs. You shouldn't be getting rid of a sow after a third litter. She's just getting really good at that point. You should be keeping her a lot longer than that. And I look at things from a whole systems approach. I mean, I kind of see the industry splitting up into a high-end where you have the Nyman Ranch type of pork, and I think some of that type of industry can be a big sector of the market. It might go up to 20%. Then there's going to be a large, intensive commercial sector that's still going to be there, especially for our low-income folks and just people that want the cheapest. It's not going to go away, but I think we can really improve that sector. And then there's a bottom niche that's really bad where people buy, you know, real rubbishy animals and sell it to, you know, Joe's Hash House.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a sector we need to phase out and get rid of.
So, and from the point of view of the animal's welfare, does that matter at all in your considerations?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, welfare matters in my consideration. Absolutely, absolutely. But it can't be the only consideration. You know, there are economic factors there that are the powerful economic factors that you just can't change. I'm going to look at whole systems. And, yes, welfare definitely needs to be part of the equation, but you can't just say it's the only thing in the equation. And I did a little survey with airline passengers to find out what people thought of sow stalls, where the sow can't turn around. And I whoever sat next to me on the plane, I told them I was doing consulting work for a restaurant company, and I wanted to talk to them about standards for proper pig housing. I wanted to make this very neutral. And then I had two pictures, and there were two sow stall pictures, and there were two just pigs on a slatted floor walking around loose. And I just showed people those pictures. And as soon as they found out that she couldn't turn around for most of her life, that crosses an ethical line that two-thirds of the public just find not acceptable. You know, I remember one guy, he was a hunter from Texas, and he said, I wouldn't put my hunting dogs in that. You know, he was just horrified. And then there was about a third of the people that just didn't care. But there was nobody from the general public that liked sow stalls. You know, now the pigs walking around loose on the slats, most people thought that was fine, and they looked very clean. But this not turning around crosses a line. Two-thirds of the public consider not acceptable, and I think it needs to be changed. It's something that's just gone too far.
Well, so your ideal system for raising pigs, would it be in these large industrial conglomerates, you know, these big sheds, or would it be a different style? I mean, do you think family farming can be economically viable again?
Yes, I do. And what I think, and I think what's happening, and I'm seeing this happen with family ranchers too. When Coleman Natural Beef started 20 years ago, the beef industry was kind of hostile towards Coleman Natural Beef. Now they've got lines and lines and lines of family ranchers lining up to be in that program. Because I think where the family ranching, you know, can be economically viable is working on these high-end, you know, welfare-friendly, organic, natural types of, you know, high-end markets. I strongly encourage this. I mean, the industry's going to stratify. And I think this high-end niche, it could get up to 25% of the market. But there's still going to be a big, intensive industrial sector that's still going to be there. It's not going to go away. Because you've got tons and tons of people of modest economic means that need to buy the cheapest meat they can get. But I strongly encourage these family farmer high-end niche markets. I've worked with some of these people to, on slaughter plant guidelines because we want to make sure that the little plants that they're using are just as good as the big plants. You know, we don't want to have a situation where the big plants are better than somebody's little plant, and that has happened. And I've been working with them to make sure they audit their plants the same way that McDonald's audits their plants.
So how quickly do you see this change coming?
Well, changes are happening rapidly, and the thing is the marketplace drives it. Like when I started back in 1999 working with for McDonald's to implement their animal welfare auditing at the packing plants, when you have a large meat-buying customer like McDonald's insisting on good welfare standards, the industry does it. You know, money talks. And when you have a large customer like that saying you're going to do this or we'll take this plant off the approved supplier list, I saw more change than I had seen in a 25-year career. In fact, in my book, Animals in Translation, I described the whole entire auditing system and how it works.
Why did McDonald's decide to lead in this direction? Were they under pressure from the marketplace?
Well, there was originally a pressure from animal rights group. If you go to the Google.com and you type in muck libel, you'll find out the whole history of it. There was a case, a lawsuit over in England where a small environmental group put out a pamphlet saying McDonald's wrecked the rainforest and they did everything terrible. And they were sued by McDonald's. But the thing is, they actually won part of the suit, especially on sow stalls and on stunning of chickens. And so now animal welfare was no longer an abstract thing that you just give to the legal department or to the PR department. It was now something that they had to do something about. So I was hired, and I took the high-level executives from McDonald's, Wendy's, and other companies out on their very first tours of farms and slaughter plants. And it was very interesting to see these vice president-level executives at many of these different companies see their eyes get opened up. You know, when things went well, they go, oh, that slaughter plant's not anywhere near as bad as I thought it was going to be. But I remember the day when one of the executives saw a skinny, emaciated, half-dead dairy cow walking up the chute at one of the plants, and they were just horrified. And they went, this is something where we need to make some change. Then my job was to train the food safety auditors. And in the beginning, as McDonald's had already been auditing plants for food safety, and they're kind of going, oh, well, why do we have to do this? But once they got started doing it, they went, wow, there's really some things we need to do here. So these food safety auditors and then all of the meat buying and what they call supply chain management group, once I took them out on these tours, they're going, wow, there's some things here we really need to work on fixing. And it just took off. You remember that book, The Tipping Point?
Yes.
Well, The Tipping Point tipped, and it was just amazing. It was the most wonderful experience back in 1999 when the tipping point tipped.
Temple Grandin, designer of livestock handling facilities. In an era when just 2% of all Americans are engaged in agriculture, few of us have ever followed the path of the meat we eat from hoof to home, and still fewer want to know what was done with it on the way. It's like making sausages. You don't want to know what went into it. But this squeamishness is a luxury we can no longer afford. With mad cow disease, bird flu, and other livestock-communicated diseases, our health becomes still more contingent on the health of our livestock. Fortunately, change is on the way. Rising public concern about the safety and quality of our food supply, coupled with a growing awareness of ethical issues surrounding the treatment of factory-farmed livestock, are prompting the hugely influential fast food industry to raise its own standards to keep customers happy. Prompted by consumer pressure, this shift is rippling through the mainstream meat production process, creating a quiet revolution, not unlike what organics have done to mainstream fruit and vegetable production. Yet even if industrial meat production responds to consumer pressure with modifications of its procedures for raising and slaughtering livestock, as long as we persist in applying an industrial template to an inherently biological process, we'll face continuing safety, quality, and ethical challenges. Pigs are not auto parts, and the metrics of the assembly line are ill-suited to live animals. Somehow we need to find ways to meet the ever-rising demand for meat in our diets without endangering our health or mistreating the animals who give their lives for our benefit. It all starts with ourselves as consumers. We can either pay the price of pork raised safely and humanely and maybe eat it a little less often, or we can pay the equally high price of eating an inferior quality of meat and living with the knowledge of the suffering that brought it to our table. Are we ready to pay the full price of our appetites? I'm Mark Summer. And this has been A World of Possibilities. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to A World of Possibilities. For more information on today's topic, please click on the listener action link at aworldofpossibilities.com. This program was produced and edited by Chuck Rogers, Tim Silva, and Malia Mulder-Wollen. Production engineer is Chuck Johnson. Special thanks to Gary Huber of Practical Farmers of Iowa. Support for this program is provided by the Kellogg Foundation. Music is courtesy of Rounder Records, Putumayo World Music, Moturn Music, Partners in Music, Alan Gerber, Water Records, and Sunroof Records. This program is distributed by the WFMT Radio Network. Thank you for listening.